Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. It is October 2nd, 2010. Welcome. And I'm with a co-host, James Moffat. Jim, how are you?
Not too bad, Chris. How are you?
Got a
bit of a
good.
Cold. Bit of a
oh, yeah, yeah, do you?
But other than that, fine, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, the fall, the change of the fall season often seems to bring colds and flus on more, I think.
Yeah, a lot of people around me have been sick for the last couple of weeks, so I've been sort of fighting it off, but, you know, like I find it kind of comes and goes. But other than that, I'm fine.
Okay. So today, Jim and I are going to pick up on some discussions we've been having for through the last three or four shows. And that's looking at the issues both of science and religion, or science and mysticism, and looking at the physics of the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky and how Blavatsky's ideas compare to modern ideas in physics and modern cosmology. So we've kind of been talking about the science and philosophy of the secret doctrine and the issues of science and such. And I've recently I had a day this week, 2 days ago, it seemed like my birthday almost. I received that same day three new proof copies of the three books I now have available as trade paperbacks. And each of the proof copies, there were no problems with them. So I have approved them, and now my three of my books are available through Amazon.com, or people can order them directly from me. And to me, it's like I've worked at my writing now for, I guess, close to 40 years, beginning with my studies of the Gurdjieff teaching, which was my main focus for over 10 years, and then the study of Eastern teachings more, the philosophy of yoga and the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads and Tibetan Buddhism, and led to kind of study of Kabbalah and secret doctrine and variety of other studies of different mystical teachers, Adi Da, Aleister Crowley, different aspects of the esoteric tradition. So I've done that now really for 40 years, trying initially to understand the origins and nature of human consciousness, because I think that issue in a way is the one which is most central to us to understand, like, what are we as living beings? Like, how each of us in our inner world has this kind of inner self-awareness, inner awareness of being. And each of us has an inner world in that way. Now, no one in the outer world can ever see your inner world. But to you, that's the fundamental thing of which you know most of all, because everything else is kind of based on it. You have this inner world of experiencing. In a way, you live in that inner world. But no one else can ever see your inner world. It can't be an object of perception for someone else. So what is the origin of that inner awareness of being within the human being? And that ties into this profound question of what are human beings? Are we simply, as science has told us for over the past century, the mainstream of science has regarded humans as primarily biological organisms which evolved through a process of natural selection and evolution and random mutations. And the conditions on Earth were just right, and life evolved out of lower life forms, maybe out of the waters and onto the land, and human beings evolved through many hundreds of thousands and millions of years up through different biological species. So in a way in modern science, that whole process is viewed as a consequence simply of the laws of nature, that's the way matter works and the evolution of these forms in a way was happenstance and circumstance that the human beings evolved in this way. Okay, and in this view, man is simply basically a biological animal, and we pursue pleasure and want to avoid pain, and we want to reproduce our genes, and we can experience different states. But the idea is that a human being has no spiritual or soul nature. And in this modern science, the issue of consciousness, scientists came to the view that somehow the brain in the head produces human consciousness. So many of the books on human consciousness, on the front cover, you'll see a picture of a head. Because of course, consciousness is produced by the mind and brain in the head. And everyone has assumed this for over a century. But scientists have never been able to explain how the brain produces consciousness or what that consciousness is. And so, in a way, consciousness is this complete enigma within within the heart of modern psychology. But there's an enigma. What is human consciousness? What produces that inner awareness of being? And no one can explain that. Like, scientists can put a person in a lab and monitor the blood flow to parts of their brains. And they can give a person arithmetic problems, and it'll light up parts of the parietal lobe and the musical rhythm, and it'll light up part of the right hemisphere. They can give different tasks to a person, and different parts of the brain become activated. So we can see where different cognitive functions and different mental capacities are within the brain, but that's separate from the issue of what is the consciousness or the awareness of those processes. And I realized over time that mystical teachings offered a whole alternative view of the origins and nature of human consciousness. Primarily, firstly, that it's not produced by material processes centered in the head. Instead, consciousness originates out of the heart. And not only consciousness, but life within the human being originates out of an original heart center. And there's actually a higher dimensional physics to the human heart, that is somehow through the heart that a human being is ensouled by spiritual intelligences. Okay, so in the heart is the meeting place where it's the place wherein God infuses light and consciousness into a human being. And this originates out of the heart. Okay, so in mystical teachings, there's actually this kind of higher dimensional zero point center connected to the human heart. And the human heart isn't just regarded as a material thing, but there's levels of the heart. See, on one level, there's the material heart. But then on another level, there's the energetic and psychical heart. And then on a higher level, there's a spiritual heart. Because I would say the heart is the abode, in a way, of the spiritual self. Okay, in the Vedas, it's called the Jiva Atma. It's like there's this spiritual self or spark, spiritual soul within the heart. In yoga, it's a jiva atma. Okay, and ultimately, a human being they're said to be a divine element associated with the heart. In Sufism, it's called a divine spark. It's also called a divine spark in Gnostic Christian teaching. Blavatsky refers to it as a monad. Bailey refers to it as the ego, but ego to put a capital on ego. So the ego in the archaic sense of what ego is, to differentiate it from a person's normal ego, a lower ego, which is centered in the mind, in the head. So all mystics are saying the self is within the heart. And that is the origin of life and consciousness within the human being. So consciousness isn't produced by material processes. Instead, consciousness is something which illuminates or allows it's light, and there's a physics to it. There's actually a light center. A human being is described as having a bliss sheath within the heart, the size of a small grape. And this is described as a mass of unemergent light. Okay, now in mystical teachings present a holographic model of the nature of existence. Now, in holography, the basis of holography is having a laser which produces a source of coherent light energy. Okay, and then that you take that beam of light from a laser and you divide it. One beam is called the referent beam. So it doesn't interact with material things. It's just a pure referent beam. And the second beam, or half of the light of this laser, is bounced off an object of perception, say an apple. And that referent beam, or object beam, illuminates the object, and then it radiates and onto the holographic plate. And it interacts with the referent beam, which didn't illuminate the object. So on the holographic plate, you have the interaction of the object, the referent beam, and the referent beam and the object beam, and these interact on the holographic plate, and the effects are through additive and diminutive effect of light on each other. These interacting wave fronts are imposed on the holographic plate. If you then illuminate the holographic plate with a laser light, it projects an image of an apple out into space. And this image is almost like three-dimensional. You can look at it and move around it. So that's the idea of holography. So in holography, they have a source of coherent light energy. Otherwise, there's no holograph. You have to have some kind of coherent light energy. So similarly, if a human being, has this higher dimensional holographic physics to the human heart. That's what I'm saying. There's a higher dimensional holographic physics to the human heart. And mystics through the ages, they didn't kind of use those terms to describe what I'm describing. What I'm trying to do is take what their work suggests and implies and see, well, what does that mean and how could that work? How can those concepts be applied to understanding the issues of science and psychology? So the idea is if somehow our awareness of being is holographic in nature, perhaps then there is actually a coherent light source within the human being. And that's how the bliss sheath is described, as a mass of unemergent light. See, in a way, that mass of unemergent light then serves as a referent beam. And some of that light then interacts with objects of experience. And it's the interaction of the referent beam and the object beam that create this inner holography within the human being. So I'm saying that, when I've studied the psychology literature on holography, beginning with Carl Prebrum and David Bohm and others, Talbot and others, is that they don't consider seriously that there is an inner light source within the human being. Okay, they apply the principles of holography to studying psychological processes, but they don't actually think that there's a laser beam within the human being. Like Carl Prebrum was once interviewed in an interview, and he says, oh, no, we don't really think there's a laser beam of light in the head. We just think that Fourier transforms can be applied to the analysis of psychological data, which means that psychological data can be broken down in certain mathematical ways into wave fronts. So that's what he was saying was the basis for holography. He didn't think there was a laser light within the brain. That's what he said. Now, I wouldn't say the laser light is in the brain, but I would say there is this mass of unemergent light within the heart. And so there is an inner illumination within the human being. And from the heart center, the idea in mystical teachings is that consciousness and life spreads out from the heart all through the body, through the blood. And that the human being is ensouled because of this living entity within the heart and through the process of oxygenation and the element of air. Okay, because the spirit is the element of fire, and the air provides a medium for the spirit life to be spread or distributed through the body. See, a person is ensouled through the breath and the oxygenation of the blood. So the blood is not, see, scientists don't think anything like blood has any psychological properties in a way. They don't consider that. You know, they think our consciousness and mind is produced in the head by neurons. But in a way, if a person in your inner experience, if you study consciousness in yourself, like if I put my attention into my right hand, what happens is within 20 seconds, my right hand engorges and is elongated is about a quarter inch. Because as I put my awareness in my hand, my blood flows there, and it engorges my hand, and I feel consciousness in my hand. Okay, so I'm saying that in the human being, your consciousness or awareness is connected to your blood flow. So if you eat a big meal and feel stuffed, and you feel that your consciousness is in your stomach, well, I would say, yeah, your consciousness is in your stomach. Doesn't mean your consciousness is only in your stomach, because you're still thinking and there's still consciousness of your thoughts in your mind, but your consciousness is also in your stomach. At different points, the blood flow is different in your body. And as your blood flow changes, so does the operation of different centers within you. Whether your mind is most active or you're emotionally centered, or whether you're physically or sexually aroused or involved. So the blood flow in the human body, see, I'm saying a human being is ensouled from the heart, and there's a living entity in there, and there's this light of that living entity, and the light of that jiva atma is the light of consciousness, which illuminates material processes so that you can be conscious of all these different things. Conscious of thoughts, conscious of feelings, conscious of objects around you, conscious of smells, all these objects of awareness. Okay, but see, the objects of awareness are always changing. Everything, the thoughts and feelings and sensations are always changing. But in a way, there's a constancy of that consciousness of. Okay, so it's like we all have this referent beam, which is like that background of like pure consciousness, or that consciousness which is no thing. You see, consciousness is, in a way, it's no thing. Instead, it's that which illuminates or allows us to be aware of the things. Okay. So anyway, through my life then, I've began with the Gurdjieff teaching for 10 years, and then I've continued it through my life, and then it was all beginning to study the mysteries of the heart and what the yogis, I took seriously what the yogis said, like what Krishna says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all living beings. Okay, so I realized, oh, this idea is in all these different mystical teachings. That's what the Sufis say. They say that there's a divine spark within the heart. And one Sufi says he calls that the secret of secrets. Okay, and the Gnostics believed it. They believed the light of the kingdom is within ourselves, and we have to seek out the light, this inner light within ourselves. In the Gnostic Gospels, Christ says, you, sons of interior knowledge, say then from the heart that you are the perfect day, and in you dwells the light which does not fail. which is of the Father and of his pleroma. So the idea is that there's this spiritual self, and it's connected to the human heart. And that consciousness and life within the human being originates out of this heart center. See, life does not come from matter. Instead, life, in a sense, comes from above, or I would say within without. See, it's life comes to us in a way out of higher dimensions, and we come into the material body, and consciousness originates out of the heart, and we come into our form as a material being. But the body is only a vehicle or body for our continued existence within this plane and within this level of materiality. But your consciousness is not dependent upon your body, okay, your physical body. And mystics describe how we have three major lower bodies, a physical body, an astral body, and a mental body. Gurdjieff calls them your planetary body, your Kesjan body, or your highest spiritual being, or highest spiritual body, he calls it, which is your mental body, your mind body. But it's a level of spiritual intelligence, spiritual mind, that we can see. And Gurdjieff explains, we have to crystallize our higher being bodies for the life of the soul. Because many people see, if you're in life, you're predominated by the concerns and issues of your planetary body, only the material level. In a way, you don't put up anything in heaven. You don't. In a way, you have to. Your life is your opportunity to form your higher being bodies for your continued existence past death into the levels of the astral plane or the mental planes, or different planes of existence. But the whole idea is, consciousness is not produced by matter. Material processes do not produce consciousness. Instead, consciousness, there's a higher dimensional physics to it. And the mystics, the way they describe consciousness as light, you see, that's a scientific perspective. That makes sense. Well, all phenomena in life involve electromagnetism in its different forms and such. So the idea that consciousness is light is a way of trying to understand many of the things revealed in mystical teachings. So through my life, in the second half phase, first was studying the Gurdjieff teaching, and that led all into studies of consciousness and the human heart. And then thirdly, I began 25 years ago, studying the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky, which Manly Hall describes as undoubtedly the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world. And book one of it deals with cosmogenesis, the creation of the universe, according to what Blavatsky says is an archaic teaching passed down to us from the higher initiates of an earlier phase of human existence. She says it was passed down by the Lords of Light to the people originally in northern Tibet at the beginning of the fifth round of our existence. We're said to be on the fifth round of the fourth cycle. So my interest is in creation physics, and I'm trying to understand. See, I'm interested in the application of physics to the science of consciousness. Like, there, in my view, see, if there's continued existence of consciousness after death, and we can pass into astral worlds or lower worlds, hell worlds, heaven worlds, different possibilities for us, depending upon the quality of our souls, then there has to be a physics to these other planes of existence. By definition, there has to be some kind of physics. Now, it would be a physics in a way beyond our physics, so in a way it would be metaphysics, like some higher dimensional metaphysics to supplement the idea that there's just material physics. Like, people used to think the world is composed of matter and energy and time and space. But in the new concepts of science, that's really very archaic, because now they believe that all of creation is sustained by a seven-dimensional hyperspace, and that there's all these complex worlds at Planckian and zero-point levels. So reality is far more complex than physicists have thought. And the more and more science advances, the world of matter disappears. Like, mainly everything around us is empty space. And you know, and then we used to think, oh, at least there was mass in the protons and neutrons in the atoms. And then now the scientists have gone into the gluons and quarks within atoms, and even the mass of atoms of nuclei have disappeared. It's like reality kind of, well, scientists added all up to nothing. It's like if you kind of add up everything that exists, it all adds up to nothing, which cancels itself out. And now scientists believe everything came out of nothingness. That's what science has arrived at, this concept, everything they call a vacuum genesis. Everything originated out of the quantum vacuum. And there's a first point of creation, a singularity emerges out of the quantum vacuum. The universe expands within, without, and eventually it might contract without, within, back to a point and back into the vacuum. And that basic concept was described by Blavatsky in 1888. She said universes originate from a zero-point condition, and at the end of time, they dissolve back into a zero-point condition. So we similarly, in mystical viewpoint, have such zero-point physics to our hearts. There's actually a higher dimensional zero-point physics to understanding what the human heart really is. And in the human being, the heart is very interesting. The heart is the center of a human being as a quantum system, or as an electromagnetic being. And the electromagnetic volume of your heart is described as 10,000 times greater than the electromagnetic volume of your mind in your head. So I would say, in Pearsall's book called The Heart Code, a commentator says, whereas the 20th century was the century of the brain, the 21st century promises to be the century of the heart. And Pearsall felt that the heart's code, he says, is connected to your soul life. And we've had this completely false understanding, thinking consciousness is produced by the brain in the head. And we fail to understand the ancient mysteries of the heart. And that's what's been elaborated through the centuries, is the mystics, like the people who seek self-knowledge and seek enlightenment and have experiences of these things, they identify the self with the heart. And so this is a profoundly important idea that this is it's a profoundly important idea then to contrast the heart doctrine of mystical teachings to the modern, what I call the head doctrine, which is the belief that the brain in the head produces consciousness, and which is considered to be a scientific viewpoint. Okay, many scientists think that science has already proven it, but when you go into it, they haven't proven anything because no one can explain it. It's a complete enigma. So these are partly the focus of our discussions, the origins of consciousness, trying to understand it in ourselves, and then studies of creation physics, trying to understand. See, I think the world, in a way, what we used to think it was, is nothing like what it really is. That somehow our awareness of the world, it's not that it's an illusion, but not meaning that it's not real. That's not, but it's an illusion what it is. And it's an illusion that we're only our material selves in the material body. That's all false understanding. Really, there's something much deeper going on, and we're multidimensional beings, And there's a whole science to understanding these processes. So that's for 30 to 40 years now, I've been kind of pursuing these types of interests and studies through my life. And through my life, I've written 6 books, but none of them have ever been published. But over the last year, I've just this last week, it felt like my birthday. I had 3 packages arrive in the mail with new proof copies of, first, my book, Psychological Illusions, Explorations of the G.I. Gurdjieff Fourth Way Teaching. And this is the most absolutely spectacular edition of this book. This book actually goes back 30 years. I was at York, Jim, when I used to use Man's Psychological Illusions, it used to be called then.
Yeah, it was your first book.
Yeah, it was my first book. And this lady, Zelchka from Croatia, has taken my files and set this up. And she set this book up in such an amazingly creative way. Yeah, I'm going to send you a copy on Monday. You won't believe how she's done it. She's kind of has black pages through the book, where the whole page is black. I'd never really seen that, but she uses that to divide the sections and all the illustrations. And she did new versions of a series of very important illustrations from In Search of the Miraculous. She redid the food diagrams, Jim, and the octaves, all the ray of creation in the different octaves. So there's all these new illustrations in this book, graphics, and it's absolutely beautifully produced book. So I'm most excited about that. And then secondly, I've just done a further edit on the Heart Doctrine. There were a couple of editorial things inside, and I modified it slightly, but it's basically the same book. But I reissued that. I just took it off for a week. And I've reissued God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. It is just announcing this week. This is now available as a trade paperback book. It's $24.95 through Amazon. Each of the books is $24.95. And they're absolutely beautifully produced. They're illustrated, probably at least 100 illustrations in each of the books. So it was like my birthday, Jim. It's like, holy smokes, I look back on my Cyrillic binding books, how I always bound them, and it's like, holy smokes, they're awful, kind of, you know. Compared to these books, I'm just so pleased with the quality of the production of these books. You got your copy of God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, Jim.
Yeah, I
did a further edit on that, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, and but the newest copy, I'm sending you a package off on Monday. I'll send you copies of each of the newest, all 3.
Oh, nice, yeah. Yeah, Psychological Illusions is it's a very interesting book. As you say, it's like, you know, you probably started it almost 35 years ago, because it basically came after your doctoral thesis and was an expansion of that. And it went through all these different versions too. Like, I remember when it was just a little 75-page stapled book, and it got bigger and bigger. And I think after you wrote it the first time, I think you sort of came back later after you had done more reading and studying on Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, and you included a lot more material, I think, based on that. Like, the earlier version was more based on Uspensky's account of Gurdjieff and In Search of the Miraculous and the Fourth Way and associated books that version, which is very different, actually, from the version that Gurdjieff puts forth later in his own writing. But I mean, it's all deals with the same things, but it deals from very different perspectives. Very interesting, actually, within the Fourth Way, how these different elements exist within the same teaching.
Yeah, that's what's fascinating about this book, is that it includes both. It has the Uspenskian version, but I brought in all basic explanations from Beelzebub's tale, so it really gives a broader overview. I don't know of anything like it as a study of the Gurdjieff teaching. It's like a textbook of the fourth way, you know?
I was going to get to that. That's what I was sort of getting at. What I was going to say was that, I think I know all the major books written in English about the fourth way and about Gurdjieff and really when we started studying the fourth way in the mid 70s there was a bunch of books that had come out like sort of in the 60s and early 70s former pupils of Gurdjieff's who wrote about him and people who were associated with Uspensky and wrote about the different aspects of the teaching and even some books into the early 80s, but since then there's really hasn't been that much in terms of the books that have been published. But I think the only really interesting, I'll take that back. I was going to say the most interesting is the work of William Patrick Patterson, who's in California, who's very interesting commentary and has addressed some interesting issues, but there isn't really any kind of, I think, really comprehensive. I think your book's probably the most comprehensive overview of the ideas in the teaching. Right? It's funny how if you read the different books, it's like it's there, but it's sort of spread out through a whole bunch of different books. Right? And I think your book kind of brings more information together probably than any other book that exists out there. So somebody's interested in the fourth way. I would definitely recommend the book. It's very comprehensive. It's very good. There's a lot in it. I mean, you could read that book over and over again and keep drawing new things out of it.
It's been so interesting for me because I haven't been focusing on this book for years, eh?
Yeah,
so it's like reading. It's like all reading it anew, you know. And I hadn't even done the final edit on it. I just. In a way, I mean, you've been through that book 3, 4, 5 times over the years, through it completely, you know, and at all different levels, even more than that when we think back how many levels it's gone through. Yeah, but it's amazing, and it's just so beautifully produced. I would say it's one of the most attractive books I've ever seen. I was shocked by it. Because when I first saw the proofs of this lady, and I kind of opened it up, and it was like the pages were all black, and I kind of just didn't get what she was trying to do. But then when you see it all together, it's quite spectacular. It's a beautiful book, just like the other two are.
Yeah, very attractive. Lots of interesting illustrations and diagrams and stuff. Yeah, it's. I started reading Psychological Illusions, part of it, I think last year, and I was really very impressed by the quality of it. It's like I was looking for things, you know, because I was writing about some fourth way ideas, and I was just looking for your explanation and some of the quotes that you use and the way that you presented it, you know, and it's very impressive, very, very interesting. And as I say, I think that's really missing in most of the books about the fourth way is that I don't think that they incorporate both the Uspenskian the Uspenskian version is Gurdjieff, but it's Gurdjieff through Uspensky, and then the later part is Gurdjieff trying to present his ideas in a very different way, more of a set of allusions and he's appealing. To simplify things, I think that like the teaching is presented in Search of the Miraculous, which consists of Gurdjieff's speeches, is more directed towards consciousness and the intellectual center. And I think the ideas as presented in Beelzebub's tales to his grandson are more to the emotional center and to appeal to conscience rather than consciousness. So it's the same teaching.
Yeah.
That's so interesting about it.
Yeah,
it acts
on you on a different level than Beelzebub's tales does.
I think that's sort of been overlooked quite a bit
in terms of
like trying to appreciate, you know, how, like one point, Madame de Salzman, who worked with Gurdjieff for many years, said that, you know, that the ideas themselves is presented, the teaching itself is presented, the form, the external content wasn't really important. He was trying to get people to a certain place, and he would go along, and then he would change it, and he would abandon whatever he was doing, and he'd, you know, start up an entirely new approach to teaching people. And I think that's sort of underlines the the intelligence of Gurdjieff's teaching, and also like the dynamic aspect of it, that it has a quality which is very very different. It's not a dogma. It's very intellectual in some ways, but it's not set down in stone that you have to understand these things in these terms. So he's trying to get you, in terms of your consciousness and your conscience, to another level, and anything that gets you there is effective. It's part of the method, I suppose.
Yeah, I think what is most interesting about the book is his characterization of the psychopathology of your favorites, those three-brained beings on planet Earth, and how kind of they form this false consciousness system and their complete kind of artificiality of things, and how he portrays people. And it's quite a hilarious book. It definitely acts on different levels than the kind of systematic intellectual presentations of Uspensky. So it is interesting. And another thing about psychological illusions, like it includes both aspects of those aspects of the study of the Gurdjieff teaching, but then it also, because of my background in modern clinical and psychology, I'm kind of comparing it with modern psychology and science, and kind of relating what they're saying to science and psychology. And I don't think many other people really do much in that way.
No, that's a very good point, because there's a fairly extensive discussion of how Western psychologists have studied consciousness and the nature of self, and in a way that you see in the comparison and contrasting of things, you see what a radically different approach, a different set of epistemological assumptions underlie the esoteric mystical teachings versus that of modern science. And I guess, too, that the other thing is that's so important, because in a way, like, what's really unique about esoteric teachings is how the psychological and the cosmological are the separation of them is in the sense it's an artifact, and that cosmology has implications for psychology and vice versa, and that's something which is entirely distinct from modern thought and from the modern science of psychology. It's a very different type of system.
Yeah, it's so amazing, just how Gurdjieff like relates a human being as having different bodies and as being interrelated to different levels of the cosmic organization. So for Gurdjieff, in a way, he says humankind is an experiment created by the sun. And that in a way, through our life, we want to attain back to this level of this solar intelligence, which is in us. And he connects that with what he calls the highest being body, which is your mental body, because the sun is taken as a realm of spiritual enlightenment and knowledge. It's regarded as a spiritual realm of intelligence. So we want to attain to the level of the sun. And then Gurdjieff says, on a lower level, so in a way we come from the sun, in a way, for Gurdjieff. Our highest self is connected to the sun. But then we're influenced by the planets, and the planetary sphere, he says, affect our essence. Like they affect our kind of nature, what we as a human being, like, Say you have the planets, and they work according to the elements of fire, air, water, and earth, representing man's spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical nature. So different people will be predominated by one or another aspect of their nature. So different people will have different essences according to planetary influences. And Gurdjieff actually sees that afterlife worlds are connected into the atmospheres, where the radiations of the planets influence the atmosphere. So Gurdjieff actually suggests that there are these worlds, subtle dimensions extending out into our atmospheres, connected to the astral worlds. And then we have a kind of a physical body. Gurdjieff calls it the planetary body. He says we have three main bodies, physical, astral, and mental bodies. And those are bodies for the fourth element, which is like the spiritual spark of the divine element within us. And it has these three bodies, which are vehicles for the soul. That's how Gurdjieff describes them. Their bodies are vehicles for the soul's existence within different planes of existence. So then Gurdjieff explains, he says, when a human being dies, or any living organic life form, there's a certain energy refers to it as the soul, but he means it in the sense of the vital life energy in the body. He says certain portion of that feeds the moon. So Gurdjieff actually, his psychology suggests that after death, people might actually pass to the moon and the lower lunar orbits. He actually talks about this. And see, if you're under 96 laws, which is how many laws he has in his ray of creation, in the beginning, everything is under one law. And then there's three laws and six laws. And the sun is 12 laws. The planet's 24 and the Earth 48 laws. And the moon is 96 laws. And it's like as you're in a lower level of nature, there's more and more laws determining your behavior rather than being free and independent, functioning independently. So it's like for Gurdjieff, the soul at death can pass into the lower lunar sphere. He at one point describes like hell as the dark side of the moon, somewhere in search. So just to come back, so the whole idea in Gurdjieff, it's absolutely fascinating, is this whole concept of how we have different bodies that embody the influences of different levels of this cosmic orientation. So that there's a sun within ourselves, the earth, the moon, the planets, like all these things come together in producing what we are. But then we also have a subtle interconnection to these realms through higher dimensions of space, or through the subtle influences propagated through space. So it kind of ties the whole study of man into the study of the cosmos in a wholly other way that you find in other sources, but no one explicates those concepts as intelligibly as Gurdjieff does. I said to, you know, one of the images that was reproduced by Zelchka for this book, Jim, was that diagram which shows the ray of creation on the left. And on the right, Gurdjieff has those four boxes. And it's the first is like the divine and the spiritual and the Kesjan body and the physical body. Has those four bodies kind of and the four and how it corresponds to the ray of creation. She redid that image really nicely in the book. And when I saw it, I kind of realized, wow, I think of all images, that image captures the essential fourth Gurdjieff teaching about like the ray of creation in our bodies and things like that. It's an absolutely profound diagram. So to bring it back a bit, so I'm most pleased, Jim, I'll send your copy off on Monday, and I thought over the next weeks, seeing this material, I thought, boy, we should go back and spend a period of time going through the Gurdjieff work more. And I'm so inspired by this book that I'm now in the process of revising The Slugs, which is my volume on Beelzebub's Tales, and I'm going to get it done as a companion book to this volume in the complete same format and the same kind of artistic presentation. So I hope to, within a month or so, to have produced The Slugs again. So I've been rereading Beelzebub's Tales and this for, so I'd really like to, you know, the last kind of month or so, we've been focusing on the secret doctrine, and I thought once you receive this book, let's spend the next few shows kind of going more deeply into the Gurdjieff teaching.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
I was thinking. We were talking about the Gurdjieff, and I was saying how my book about him tries to relate his ideas to modern psychology and science, and I was just thinking, like, something even most simple. Like, I remember, like, studying the Gurdjieff teaching, some of the early ideas which struck us immediately both, I think, so profoundly that we realized that, like, this is a brilliant psychology. And one of the ideas was that, like, modern psychology, Gurdjieff describes as dualistic. They always see things in a dualistic way. And in psychology, it's always in modern century been defined as the science of behavior and the mind. That they think we have a mind in the head, and then the mind is connected to the body. So kind of modern psychology has always had this kind of dualistic conception of human beings. You have a mind-body, and all of these philosophers talk about the mind-body dilemma. How can an immaterial mind affect a material body? You know, that was kind of dualistic thinking about consciousness or about human psychology. And then you read the Gurdjieff and his explanations. He says, well, a human being really has three major natures. He functions mentally, emotionally, and physically. Okay, and so, three centers. He says three major aspects to us. So right away, well, you see, modern psychology, they believe in the mind, the intellectual center, and they believe in the physical self, but they don't regard emotions as, like, on the same status, as a separate aspect to human nature. So Gurdjieff had, you know, instead of human beings functioning only mentally and physically, it's mentally, emotionally, and physically, the threefoldness of human beings, or head, heart, and hands. Okay, your head, your mind, your intelligence, your heart, your emotions, and your vitality and life force, and then your hands, your physical, material body, capable of sensation and movement. So we really have a threefold nature. And then Gurdjieff says, and that can further be broken down into the seven centers. And I won't bother going all into that now, but even something like there was one idea. You realize when you study the Gurdjieff teaching about the centers, how he breaks it down into seven centers and the three aspects to our nature, how that's thought so much more comprehensive than the kind of simplistic, dualistic thinking of the mind and the body that's dominated modern psychology for 100 years. Now, that was one example. And it's useful to get that perspective on what he's saying. Like, when he says that we have a three-brained beings on planet Earth, all the time he refers to us as three-brained beings, okay? Whereas in modern psychology, they've always thought, well, there's just one mind in the head. They don't see the body as having a mind, whereas in Gurdjieff, you know, there's the intelligence of the body, there's the intelligence of the heart, and there's the intelligence of the mind in the head. Like, each of these is a form of mind or brain. So Gurdjieff says, well, there's not one brain, there's three brains or seven brains. So it's a whole different idea, and that was one idea. Jim, in our early studies of the Gurdjieff teaching, we saw how profound that was, that simple kind of distinction.
Yeah, and I think, too, like, this idea that the centers are, like, distinct brains and that they each have their own way of knowing and that they each have their own speed of operation and their own specific type of memory and that they're located, all of them are located throughout the body, but they each have a locus or a center of gravity so that the head brain is, the intellectual center is centered in the head brain and the emotional center is in the nerve plexus in the abdomen, and then the moving instinctual center is in the spinal cord and the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. It's a completely different model, but it really addresses a lot of sort of anomalies that arise because of this false dichotomy between the mind and the body. And then when it's expanded into, like, what you were talking about before, about the idea that we're multi-dimensional, multi-bodied beings, like, we have these higher, subtler bodies that inform and interact with our physical bodies. Like, it's such a complex model that really puts things on a different footing. For me, like, that one, the big thing, just like the positing of the existence of the emotional center, really addressed what I saw as, like, as a psychology student, what I saw in psychology was how overlooked and misunderstood emotional processes were, except within the clinical literature, where you have psychoanalysts who talk a fair amount about emotional processes, but within academic experimental psychology, there's very little discussion of emotions. And if you want to study emotions, you put an affective, quote-unquote, variable into a study. But it's so simplistic and so ridiculous that it really doesn't tell you anything about, you know, people are emotions are such complex processes. And I mean, the one aspect of the emotional center that's never discussed within modern psychology is the process of identification, which is discussed extensively throughout the esoteric literature, and which is central to understanding the nature of consciousness. And it's completely overlooked and misunderstood within modern psychology.
Yeah, there were so many subtle, simple things even that were so profoundly insightful. Like, after learning about head, heart, and hands, I could just see this kind of superficiality of so much of Western writing about psychology. Even how you have foundations for mental health. Everybody thinks, what we need is mental health. But it's not like, well, how about emotional health? Like, they don't even realize that, emotional health and mental health, I mean, they go together. But there's different aspects of the same thing. It's like all the head brains, all the intellectual scientists and psychologists thought that mental problems are all mental based, kind of. You know, over time, you know, they have all these affective disorders. But they don't even understand something. They think, you know, human beings' problems are mental problems. They're in your mind. You know, they don't grasp, no, the deeper problems are connected to the heart and the physics of the heart and how people are damaged through the heart, so they don't feel their essential consciousness. Why do you think you have schizophrenia? Because you have splitting between the minds or brains in the human being, so that the thoughts and feelings are out of conjunction. The person can't function as a whole. They're not one whole. They're these kind of different parts which become split off from each other. The mind can't cope with the emotional, and it's split off. There's this splitting in the psyche because there are these different brains or aspects to the same person in the same body. Whereas modern science kind of thinks, there's one mind, you know. But Gurdjieff's teaching is so much more subtle and complex. No, there's different minds, you know, and they can function quite independently of each other. It's a fascinating. Another issue idea from Gurdjieff, which, like, at the time I was a psychologist interested in psychology and influenced by Western studies, and Uspensky said, you know, to study, understand consciousness, he says, you have to separate consciousness from what he calls the psychic functions of thinking, feeling, and sensation. That consciousness is not thinking, it is not feeling, it is not a sensation. Consciousness is something separate. And he says the best thing is to describe it as light. The consciousness illuminates or allows you to be aware of different objects of consciousness. So you can be aware of your thoughts, but that doesn't make your thoughts. Your thoughts aren't consciousness. Your thoughts are an object of awareness. But add as many thoughts as you want and add them all up, you never get consciousness out of it. Consciousness is something separate from thinking. It's like you have light in your room, okay, and that light illuminates your room so you can see all different things in your room. Okay, well, so the light is the consciousness, and in your inner world it illuminates, and it illuminates all these thoughts, feelings, sensations, desires, volitions, insights, all these different things are objects of consciousness. But somehow there's that consciousness as a referent beam, you know, and yeah. So So at that point, when I saw the fourth way teaching and how essential Uspensky said that point was, that consciousness is separate from the psychological functions. And I saw at the same time all Western psychology was influenced by William James, who said, by states of consciousness are meant such things as thoughts, feelings, intuitions, and the like. Okay, so James kind of said, no, you add all your thoughts and your feelings and your sensations over time. You add those all together, and that's what consciousness is. And he called it the stream of consciousness, which he also interchangeably used with the term the stream of thought. So he kind of confused consciousness and thinking all the time. So when I read that in Uspensky, I realized, oh, this is profoundly important. This is a key to understanding the mystical conception of human consciousness. Consciousness is not thinking or feeling or sensation. It's both like light, which illuminates, and it's also like space, because there's something about consciousness which is, it has to do with the idea of empty space. See, it's like there's light within empty space. See, so consciousness, in a way, it's like there's this nothingness at the heart of being, in a way. In a way, each person, in our innermost nature, we come out of this nothingness at the heart of being, out of kind of an empty space. And that empty space is always there in the background. It's like it's a referent beam, the nothingness. You see, and then over top of the nothingness, you have all the creation of all the different things that we can be aware of. But all the different things come out of the nothingness. So consciousness is like the nothingness. It's like that thing which isn't like a material object. It can't be the object of your perception. You can't be conscious of the consciousness as an external object. So consciousness is both like light and it's like empty space. That's why Aleister Crowley uses as a symbol for consciousness a point within a circle, because that point, in a way, represents the divine spark or the spiritual self, the I. And that point in the circle, and then the circle represents space. Okay, so it's kind of the conjunction of this point source of light within empty space, which gives rise to human consciousness, as I understand it. That's what's involved. So it's a complex and kind of difficult subject. So consciousness is, it's such a mysterious, like the issue of consciousness is the most mysterious subject in modern science, and it always has been. And in the mainstream of science, scientists, we can't even define what the consciousness is, yet alone know how to identify how the brain produces it. It's still, and there's so many insights into understanding consciousness which are useful within a mystical perspective, especially these ideas of consciousness as light and consciousness, conceiving of it as a form of nothingness like space within which you can be aware of things. So even in A. Jim, in the very first kind of, in a way, simple ideas in Uspensky's books, you know, consciousness is different from the psychological functions, and consciousness is like light, or Uspensky says, a background upon which things reveal themselves. See, that's like the space. It's a background. It's this light that pervades space, and that it's that field of light within space, empty space, that then allows you to be aware of all the things, different thoughts and feelings and sensations. And the same thinking works how you could even have all different lifetimes. And you could have that same awareness in a whole different lifetime with all different objects of perception and experience and personality and so on. And you could have a consistency of that inner consciousness.
Well, I think, you know, in terms of the fourth way, like in terms of studying consciousness, especially as people trained in Western psychology, I think to me the most important thing that I got out of my introduction to the fourth way, like immediately was this idea that you have to study consciousness within yourself and you have to study it systematically. And at one point, Uspensky said to Gurdjieff, you know, it's generally agreed that consciousness is indefinable and that you can't really know it. And Gurdjieff said, well, all of this is usual scientific sophistry, rubbish. He said, there's only one thing that you said which is actually accurate, which is that you can know it within yourself. And he said, but if you observe consciousness within yourself, if you attempt to observe it within yourself, what you'll find is that you'll experience it variations in the level of your consciousness. Sometimes it's present, sometimes it's absent. But one thing that you have to understand is that you can only observe it when it is present. That there are, what happens is that you lose consciousness, and that there are long periods of complete mechanical working of the human machine in which you are not really conscious at all, or you're conscious at such a low level that your consciousness is almost non-existent. And then you'll have a moment of consciousness when you sort of come to and you're more aware of yourself being here, thinking, acting, and feeling. And then it'll disappear again. And he said if you observe systematically the appearance and disappearance of consciousness, you'll see something that you don't understand now, that most of the time it's virtually absent, and that moments of consciousness are very rare and are separated by these long periods of mechanical working of your machine, where the psychological functions occur without much consciousness. And again, we can compare that to light. So most of the time, the consciousness is a very, very dim light. And then we have moments when we're sort of more aware of ourselves in this moment here, thinking, acting, and feeling. And so those are moments of greater illumination. And Gurdjieff said this is such an important thing to understand, because it's the beginning of trying to acquire consciousness. Why would you work to try to acquire something that you already believe? He said your principal mistake is believing that consciousness is either always present or never present, whereas it's really much more variable than is understood. And so that what you have to do is you have to make an effort through the process of what he calls self-remembering, which is to remind yourself to try to be aware, to try to be more conscious as you think, act, and feel. And then above and beyond that, it's so interesting, because you can become more conscious in, say, your physical center. Like, let's say you're doing something where you're working physically and you're very aware of yourself doing something, and you work more effectively. But at the same time, like, mentally and emotionally, you can be quite unconscious, and then you might be more conscious in your emotional center, where you're having like strong feelings, or where you're in a state of intense emotional presence, but you don't have much awareness of yourself physically or of your thoughts, because you're having sort of automatic thoughts. And that's the other side of it. It's like Gurdjieff says, is that we don't understand that we have these three centers within ourselves, and that they're continually interacting with one another, and we don't realize how, like, a wave of emotion will start a whole series of physical processes, which will be accompanied by certain types of ideas, or certain types of ideas will set off emotional processes. And this can happen, and generally happens quite mechanically and with very little consciousness. So you have to start to understand what it is within yourself that prevents you from being conscious, and what can do to increase your consciousness. And so that's, to me, was the biggest thing for me, is to realize that, oh, see, everything in modern Western psychology's attempt to become a science has denied self-study. It's like we don't study ourselves. We study to get objective knowledge. The premise in modern psychology is that we have to externally observe others, whether they're other human beings or laboratory animals or whatever, because only that which is externally observable, it can be objective. And that's the great fallacy of modern science. All of that derives from Galileo, saying only that which is quantifiable can be objective and scientific. Well, Galileo, you know, it's odd, because Galileo is always celebrated as a great victor over the dogma of the church, right? Because he challenged the dogma and said you have to experiment, you have to rely on observation to question question that which has been handed down as belief. But the other side of it is that with Galileo, you had the dismissing of experience as a realm of study. Like that quality went out with Galileo's insistence on externally observable measurement and quantification. And so essentially, since Galileo, everything in modern science has gone towards getting rid of quality, anything which can't be quantified, and eventually doing away with experience. And that's why you had, within psychology, you had this bizarre school which dominated modern Western psychology for 50 years of behaviorism, which denied that anything was going on inside human beings, which is completely and utterly idiotic. But it was the most important theoretical position in modern psychology. So as a Western psychologist, a student of psychology, both of us, like, when we came across this, like, that's what jumped out at me more than anything, is that, oh, you can observe this in yourself, and you can see certain things, and it's empirical in the sense that I can observe this in myself, and you can observe this in yourself. And we can have a dialogue about it and say, you know, when I do this, this happens, or when I'm experiencing these things, I notice this. Well, that's as empirical as saying, you know, when I drop the rock, you know, and the feather off the Leaning Tower of Pizza, you know, like, here's what we observe. Eh? Like, it's the fallacy of modern science is to dismiss all this. And reading the beginning of Stephen Hawking's book, I read about the first 80 pages this morning. Not much of a book. His history of science is so completely. It's like the traditional, you know, party line dogma of the materialist reductionist position. It's completely idiotic, you know, and it's a complete misrepresentation of and gross oversimplification of the history of science. It's so funny. It's like this is the most famous scientist in the world, but that book is stupid. I mean, that's the only word I can say. It's a dumb book, you know. What I've read of it, and then I read your review, which is very good, by the way. It's just dumb. I mean, it's so selective. I mean, Sagan is 100 times more nuanced than Hawking. It's not a very good presenter. So, as you say, it's all of this has been told many times before, and a lot better, actually, quite frankly, in other science books. It's so self-serving because I can already, you know, he's talking about Feynman's interpretation of the double slit experiment with the, and he's leading to, of course, is the multiverse and the idea that, you know, that there are multiple worlds, so all possibilities exist, and therefore our presence here is really just because everything's possible, so we're possible. It's a completely ludicrous argument. I mean, in a funny way, it might actually be true, but it's so unscientific the way he's arguing. I can't believe it. But again, it goes back to this whole idea. Like, there's no discussion in his book of consciousness or, you know, the nature of life. I mean, at one point he says, well, everything alive is basically just physics and chemistry. So that's life and consciousness solved for him, you know.
And that's science. That's the other thing.
That's scientific. I mean, that's a gross oversimplification of all of the real questions in science, you know. It's just so ludicrous. I couldn't believe it when I was reading it. It's like, you know, it's like a high school kid who's sort of enthralled by certain, you know, physician and science, and, you know, has that kind of fervor, but it's just so ridiculous. But it's entirely consistent with all the wrong thinking about consciousness and the nature of life. As you said earlier, like this idea that consciousness and life arises from within the heart, you know, and is stepped down and manifests from these higher dimensions through the physics and metaphysics of the within the heart is a very different perspective and really quite dramatically different from that which modern science puts forth.
Yeah, and yet at the same time, what's so interesting about it is that it's a scientific perspective. Like, it has hypotheses, it postulates certain things, it's testable, it's ideas you can do experimentation and studies within that framework of understanding. Like what you could take the ideas, like I say, connect consciousness to blood flow. There's all kinds of ways of investigating that in labs and with subjects. You know, you try to get them to do different tasks and you monitor blood flow and, you know, you try to get people to be aware of their blood flow and monitor and influence their blood flow. All kinds of ways you can investigate that idea of the connectedness between consciousness and blood flow. Like it leads to a whole variety of experimentation. And many of these ideas, like it's the old dualistic way of thinking, oh, there's religion and science. It's a false duality because scientists like Hawking, in a way, represent everything most feeble-minded in science, which is kind of superficial, mechanistic, materialist kind of philosophy that underlies it. But they confuse that philosophy with the results of science, and you don't need to link those. Like, I can take M theory and modern ideas about holography and physics and give them the same ideas a whole mystical interpretation. You know, whereas he will take those same ideas and conclude that proves that life evolves from matter. But there's a whole, but he presents, because he's this great scientist, then people kind of think that his philosophizing is part of science, but it's not. That's his philosophizing, his superficial philosophizing. That's not science. You know, and it's a complete leap of faith on his behalf to get from the scientific theories and data to where he gets. But he doesn't present that. He's not just saying it's my opinion. He kind of presents it as though it's the results of scientific inquiry. And that's fraudulent in a way. It's, you know, like Stephen Hawking, he traces the universe back to nothingness. And then he's concerned about the first point singularity of creation, okay? And these are issues in modern physics. Okay, the fact that the mystics have traced the universe back to nothingness for centuries or millennia, and that mystics have had this concept of the point source origin of the universe. I mean, mystics have been saying these things for hundreds or thousands of years. And then scientists arrive at that, and they say, oh, now we believe the universe came out of nothingness and it came from a point. Okay, and they think, oh, we've discovered this. Oh, this is the advances of modern physics, and now this proves God doesn't exist. I mean, it's so completely fraudulent. Because those very facts of science itself, vacuum genesis, singularities, higher dimensions, all these ideas and facts of science are supporting what the mystics have claimed for hundreds and thousands of years. Whereas he's kind of taking those facts and twisting it around and saying, oh, now we can explain everything just with science and we don't need God. We can't fault him.
It's not just him too. I mean, it's all of these guys. But I mean, it's astonishing that somebody this smart could be that stupid. That's my interpretation.
Yeah.
That's the way I regard reading him. It's stupid. I was going to say, maybe that's not the right word, but I regard it as stupid. I find his book and his pronouncements on these things are really quite profoundly ignorant, because I don't think he knows what he's talking about. He has such a limited perspective on these things, and he argues from such a limited perspective that he just completely misses the significance of so much in the quest of human knowledge to know ourselves and the cosmos. And I mean, it's like when a guy like Weinberg writes to the more we study things, the more that just seems that we're a farcical outcome of a bunch of accidental happenings and chance circumstances and all this. Well, you know, that's his interpretation, but that's not science, you know. That's his interpretation and extrapolation.
Yeah.
What struck me in reading Hawking's book is that recently I just reread David Bohm's conversations with Rene Weber in Dialogues with Scientists and Sages. And I mean, here's a guy who is Bohm is a quite an accomplished physicist, and it's so interesting the difference in the tone between that, because whereas Hawking says, well, we know this, this, and this about physical reality and in terms of modern physics and thought, so then we can draw all these conclusions, whereas Bohm says, you know, really, at one point he's talking about quantum mechanics, and in Hawking's book, Hawking quotes Feynman, who says, nobody really understands it, right? I mean, when you get right down to it, they don't. So they have, there are different interpretations of quantum mechanics, and what Bohm points out is that, you know, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics under Bohr is eventually sort of won out. But what he points out is de Broglie had an entirely different understanding of things. They put forth a different interpretation of quantum mechanics. And he said, if you take his interpretation, it leads directly to what he's positing, which is the existence of an implicate order and a super implicate order, like these higher dimensions that inform the material physical dimension, that there are these higher dimensions. Well, you'd never guess that in a million years in reading Hawking, that there is even any doubt about any of this. Like, it's so dogmatic the way he presents things, and so so narrow. Like, there's no wonder in it, kind of. It's just like, oh, we just got all this figured out. Like I say, his discussion of life is like, it's like two sentences. Then he has, like, he's quotes some unreferenced study about the brain and about being able to stimulate areas of the brain and make people think that they've done things when they haven't done them at all, like, you know, and that, so there's no free will. It's like, it's ludicrous. Like, this guy joking or what? You know, like, and so, you know, but it's not just him. There's there's lots of people who are scientists who would adhere to a materialistic explanation of things and reductionist perspective on studying things, but it's very disappointing that somebody that intelligent, as they say, could be that simple-minded about such big questions. And as I say, in contrast with somebody like Bohm, or like when I just reread Bernard Haitian's book, you know, The God Theory, another physicist, you know, a very intelligent guy who has a very different, you know, understanding of things from that which Hawking puts forth. And it doesn't
He ends up postulating omnipresence, holofield, Akashic record. Like this Akashic field, which is like this kind of realm of nothingness that kind of sustains all life out of this Akashic field, which is Blavatsky's ether. You know, and so there's Laszlo, like he is an absolute world apart from Hawking,
the God theory guy, but I mean, he says the same thing, that, you know, he thinks of God as like this intelligence which just didn't create things. And that's another thing, is like when Hawking talks about God, I think he talked, you know, his idea is like that God created things and then sort of stood back. I mean, he has a very, I don't know what his concept of God is really, but a very, like, God sort of created the natural laws and then, you know, just stepped back and God wasn't involved anymore. So
how mystics, I think, view it too, eh? Well, like the law, like Gurdjieff does. Like he says, like the will of the absolute sets it in motion, but then there's like a hierarchy of forces and intelligences that make that plan manifest.
Well, that's it, and it's dynamic, and I mean, really, like, and even that, like, there's a differentiation between the Godhead and God, like the Trinity, and then God, which is beyond all comprehension and all conceptualization, and which it just is, you know, and that is Uspensky, or as Blavatsky says, you know. Yeah. So I mean, yeah, you know, these are enormously complicated questions, but you never get that idea of reading Hawking. It's just like, it's all so simple to him, you know. Like I was quite astonished really reading his book. It's easier to read than A Brief History of Time, but it's just sort of this cookie cutter presentation of the history of science, which I really object to. Like, he talks about Pythagoras and, you know, a couple of sentences and no mention of, like, you know, the idea of, like, the mystical nature of Pythagoras' teachings, or the idea of Pythagorean, the importance of Pythagorean thought and Neoplatonism, and how, like, that, you know, shaped intellectual history of the, you know, several hundreds of years, you know, and like there's just like it just doesn't exist, you know, like it's all sort of invisible to him, and it's kind of astonishing in the sense that he doesn't seem to be aware of these things. I don't think he really knows that much about.
Yeah, it's such a simplified, biased presentation of what science is and what science has arrived at. I mean,
yeah.
It's really superficial. And you'll see his presentations of M-theory. Like, I explain M-theory in more detail and
yeah.
elaborated than he does in his work. And he mentions a holographic. He throws a line in mentioning, the new emerging holographic paradigm. Well, the new emerging holographic paradigm completely kind of challenges, you know, it's a whole alternate kind of model. And he doesn't say anything about it. It's like he's saying, we're almost solving the mysteries with these new theories, and they prove that God doesn't exist. But he kind of doesn't explain what those theories are or anything of them. It's like promissory science.
It's funny too, because 30 years ago, like when Ken Wilber put out the holographic paradigm and other paradoxes, and one of the things he said was that, you know, despite his own reservations about the holographic paradigm, that at the very least it was showing that, you know, that the spirit, if you subscribe to this position that spirit, that, you know, was allowing for spirit at the very least, and that eventually people might come to the position where they'd say, you know, do you believe in spirit? Like scientists used to say, no, I'm a scientist. Do you believe in spirit? Yeah, because I am a scientist. Like this.
It was a completely revolutionary
yeah. understanding of the metaphysical implications of where science is taking us. But even you know, in terms of 20th century science, like no discussion of like all of these major figures in physics, like Eddington and Sir James Jeans and Bohr, and all of these people, and what their commentaries on what they thought quantum mechanics and relativity theory was revealing about the nature of reality, all of which challenges the viewpoint that he's putting out. You know,
what's even so unusual a bit is you have this whole new paradigm emerging in physics itself, which views information as a third force.
Yeah.
And how, you know, the new models of black hole physics, how black holes could be seen as mini processors, information processors. And you have all those kind of new emerging ideas, but like to him, it's not even relevant, kind of. Like, in a way, those issues are relevant to kind of understanding mystical teachings. Because, like, in mystical teachings, reality, external manifestations of reality, manifestations of matter and energy, are guided by underlying intelligences. And these intelligences pervade space in a way, within the quantum field information of things. So there's this whole realm of intelligence underlying creation. So now they have all these new ideas about information as third force in science and black holes as mini processors in higher dimensions, all of which has application to understanding mystical teachings. But, I mean, Hawking doesn't go into any of the complexity of any of those things. That's what I found most disappointing by his book. I wish he kind of explained some of the newer ideas and you know, how he has always been wanted a quantum theory of gravity. He's been talking about it for 20 years, okay? And in this book, it's like it didn't even exist as a problem, and he doesn't solve it in any way or say anything about the new ideas of gravity, which is in holographic physics, all has to do with higher dimensional spaces, which underline and sustain material phenomena. So, but I mean, none of that, like, it's like it doesn't really matter. It's like his mind is set up ahead of time, and he kind of does a superficial kind of overview of philosophy of science, and he ignores so many things. What does he say about the enigmas of action at a distance or non-local effects?
Well,
in his book, there's nothing on it.
That's what I was, you know, that's you just identified exactly that. That was my interpretation of his book, is that he already has his mind set on, you know, reaching a conclusion, and then he makes his argument, and then he overlooks all of these intriguing enigmas and mysteries that confront physics, and yeah, non-locality is like the biggest one, and you know, this I underline a few things, like where he has quotes, he's talking about Aristotle's ideas and his theoretical perspective, and I'm thinking, well, you could sort of apply this to your own, and you know, showing the weakness in Aristotle, but you could, you know, his is sort of the flip side of that, and then he's talking about what's required for theory. Well, this whole idea of the multiverses as you know, explaining the weak and the strong anthropic principle is like, why are things so finely tuned that we are here? Like, why, you know, it certainly seems on a certain level that somehow we are intended to be here, and that nature it does give indications that there's a creative intelligence behind the creation of the universe because of the fine tuning of so many of these significant aspects of the structure of the physical universe. It's just like, it's mind-blowingly unlikely that this could happen by chance. So his explanation is the multiverse idea, which is that there are all of these different 10 to the 500 possible different universes. So really, all we are is that the fact that we're here is explained away by the fact that really, you know, we're just that lucky chance. Like, there are all these other universes that we don't know, where things wouldn't have worked out this way. And so really, you can explain all these things by saying that anything's possible, because that's basically the explanation. Anything's possible.
Yeah.
That's why. It's a non-explanation. And where the hell is Occam's razor through all this?
Yeah, really.
You know, like that's the thing that scientists, materialists are always sort of incited, you know, are always invoking Occam's razor. Well, you don't want to invoke any other unnecessary principles to prove things that you don't need to. Well, you know,
yeah,
this is the ultimate violation of Occam's razor. It's like, oh, anything's possible if everything's possible. Well, yes, you know, but it doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's so stupid. I mean, the funny thing is, it could be true. Like, I'm not disputing that.
Yeah, no.
The idea of the multiverse is, in fact, I think there's sort of that suggestion. Like, at one point when Gurdjieff's talking about the ray of creation, it's like this dissension of world orders from the absolute, like of these different levels of creation, and he says there may be an infinite number of rays of creation, you know, like there might be all sorts of them. So I'm not disputing that could possibly be true. What I'm disputing is that this is any kind of an explanation. It's certainly not a scientific explanation. How would you observe any of these things?
Is it that falsifiable, as Popper's definition?
Well, it says the mathematics of M theory predict this. Well, the explanatory value of that theory isn't very good if that's, you know, that aspect of it is kind of weak in my humble estimation. If it basically, like I said, it's like it's a tautology. You know, there's no logic to it, or there's no deductive logic to it. Let's put it that way. Like, you can't.
Well,
say, like,
I mean. It's like what you said, like going back to Occam's razor, that you don't kind of postulate unnecessary or additional factors to account for something. You try to prefer. And if we think of what Hawking has really done, is postulated his additional factor is a universe of 10 to the power of 500 possibilities. Which is, absolutely anything is possible. So the fact that this happened, oh, we don't need to worry about it because everything was possible. It's so funny. It really is.
Yeah,
as you say, though, like what he's arguing, the argument that there's intelligence, and it's a very interesting argument, and it's a very interesting point being made by M theory, and it's a good proposition, and you know, it's a concept to think about, and I think it's valuable in that way, but it's what he arrives at as a conclusion from it all.
And that again is like that's his consistent thing is to overstep his, you know, it's bad science is to overstep. His interpretations aren't supported by the data that he's referring to, or that he's, you know, that he's holding up as substantiating his position. It's just like his position isn't derived from observation and experimentation. It's derived from his desire to get to a certain conclusion, and it's so transparent to anybody who has a differing viewpoint. That's what's so astonishing to me about his book is that, as I say, I think the arguments that he's making have been made better by other people, but I still don't agree with them. And even like with the, you know, the multiverses, it's still like, who's to say that this isn't, you know, this is a kind of big question, but who's to say that God isn't creating all these multiverses, that there isn't an intelligence behind all of that? And essentially that's what the mystics say, is that, you know, there is this omniscient intelligence behind it all, which is, you know, like in Blavatsky's words, thrills through every finite point of creation, or whatever that quote is to that effect.
Yeah.
That's a criticism that materialists always have to say. Well, you can always say, well, you know, behind it all is God, but, well, is that really... it's not really different from saying behind it all are 10 to the 500th, you know, different universes. I mean, but the thing is that with God is that in higher spiritual intelligences, people have directly experienced this. Like that's the piece of evidence that doesn't exist in that multiverse perspective. But it does exist in people's accounts of, you know, through mystical and esoteric teachings that, you know, throughout history, that people have experienced directly these higher realities, and there's a consistency to them, you know, and there's a consistency to the interpretation of the dynamics of these things that you pointed out so well at the beginning of the program when you're talking about the heart doctrine. Over and over and over again, different languages, different systems, different cultural, historical periods. You have people arguing the same thing. Well, that's what I would call science. You know, like that's a science of consciousness and being, because it's people have followed certain injunctions. If you do this, then you will observe this, and you know they've come up with the same interpretations.
You can do that in the inner world.
Yeah,
it's like yogis have methods of cultivating states of samadhi.
Yeah,
like there, and you know, and there would be a physics. In my view, there is an actual physics to a state of samadhi. Like there has to be by definition. You might want to call it metaphysics. Like it's a physics beyond our understanding of physics. But I mean, see, there's so many. It's so much in modern writings on physics. Scientists don't really connect the levels from their level of study down at Planckian levels and the elementary particles. They don't relate that level meaningfully to the level on which we live our existence.
Yeah.
Like this is all on a level so far beyond our perception.
Yeah, big disconnect there.
Yeah, completely. It's a world removed from our world of people and cars and things like that. Okay, even though it pervades everything.
But
at least on some level. And they'll talk about the things way down on, you know, the nature of photons and electrons and stuff like this and particles and such and the unusual properties. And then they jump up and extrapolate. Well, they don't relate it. They don't really relate how all these things going on at that level relates to us as existing beings existing on this whole alternative level of reality made up of all these processes. They don't make that jump. That's what you need mystical teachings for.
Yeah, and there's a lack of...
To connect those.
Yeah, and I mean, at the same time, like what quantum mechanics has taught us is that you know, that the laws of nature operate in different ways on different levels of scale. Like, I mean, in the material world, that's very clearly true. Like, you know, I mean, you know, Newtonian classical, you know, physics works for big objects you know, at normal speeds. But as you speed up and get closer to the speed of light, then relativity theory becomes becomes necessary. And if you break things down to very small levels of matter, then quantum mechanics becomes necessary. So you have different theoretical explanations and seemingly different laws operating. Like things that happen in the quantum mechanical world don't happen on the level of human beings and, you know, the material world that we live in. They just don't. Like, so that's what mystical teachings talk about all the time, is that you have this scale, this gradation of different levels of subtlety of matter and consciousness, and that it exists in this hierarchy, and that, you know, I mean, it's a very complex explanation of the nature of reality, which seems to me to have anticipated what's happened in the certain ways in physics, and has a much better explanation of how this happens. As you say, like, for example, information now is being recognized in addition to matter and energy as the third force in terms of explaining the material world. Well, that's been taught, you know, in the teachings of the three gunas, or the three zazahat, or hidden splendors in Kabbalah, or third force, the law of three in Gurdjieff's teaching. It's through all sorts of mystical and esoteric teachings. The law of three is repeatedly described, you know, in all of these teachings, and matter, intelligence, and energy.
Mm-hmm.
Some variation of that. So, like, I would say that's an example of how ancient mystical esoteric ideas have anticipated something, you know, that's one of the overriding criticisms that's always voiced about mystical and esoteric teachings, is that they don't really predict or anticipate anything that modern science discovers. But that's just not right. Like, that's completely wrong, you know.
Let's just consider that. Let's just to give me a moment to answer that, like, let's consider what, if you had understood Blavatsky's secret doctrine in 1888, okay? And I remember Stephen Hawking said, in the 18th century, everybody can't believe, they didn't know whether the world had a beginning or not, or had been created in its present form. I forget the exact quote, but it was...
Yeah.
Basically that people had no idea of the origin of the world, and that's what he was saying about the mainstream in the 19th century. Well, what Blavatsky in 1888 was proposing, first, that we live in the multiverse, which is Hawking's conclusion. Like, Hawking says, oh, in his universe there could be 10 to the power of 500 possibilities. Okay, well, I mean, for Blavatsky, that's the eternity of the absolute, you know, which is like this infinite being. So even 10 to the power of 500, even Hawking's huge number, kind of like, you know, let's put 500 more zeros on it, you know. We can play with numbers, and like God. So Blavatsky had a multiverse produced out of this kind of infinite being of possibilities. She also predicted that, like, creation would appear as if emerging out of nothingness, like it emerges out, the causative principles are in the realm beyond physical manifestation, and events in metaphysical realms precede what is then made manifest in the physical realm. And she postulated that the universe grew from a point source, okay, a singularity, and she was saying this in 1888. It wasn't for 100 years before scientists arrived at the singularity, what Hawking called the naughty point. He called it was these naughty points, these singularity points. Okay, but Blavatsky predicted then seven-dimensional hyperspace. She called it the seven-skinned eternal parent space. And the newest idea is that the big thing in M-theory is 11-dimensional space with seven compacted dimensions at every point, which is a seven-dimensional hyperspace. So Blavatsky predicted vacuum genesis, singularities, expanding, contracting space-times out of a multiverse. You know, she predicted the expansion from a point at the beginning of time. She predicts the absorption of the universe at the end of time back into a layer point, a zero point at the end of time, where scientists in modern times think the universe will just expand infinitely. So Blavatsky has a different prediction for that. Blavatsky said that gravity, as we thought we understood it, didn't exist. That it's gravity is not due to the effects of material mass of matter upon itself, but rather it's a variation of the fundamental electromagnetic force propagated through the ethers, which he called Fohat, and the seven variations of Fohat. So for Blavatsky, things like suns and galaxies have living zero-point centers, and the influences of these zero-point centers are propagated through the levels of space surrounding those centers. So the galaxy is held together not by matter, which we can't find, but it's held together because of the zero-point physics of the singularity at the center of the galaxy, and that those influences are propagated through levels of the ether that pervade that galaxy. So Blavatsky doesn't see a galaxy as held together because of brute mass, but rather it's due to these electromagnetic influences propagated through the ethers, because there's a zero-point center. Okay, so it's a whole different model of how the formation of a galaxy or a solar system. It's an alternative model, and Blavatsky's ideas about gravity are now becoming more acceptable, because scientists are realizing now that it does appear to be a variation of electromagnetic influence. And the newest ideas about why do things fall to the Earth is because of electromagnetic fluxes within the ethers. Okay, so the newest conceptions of gravity and how they're trying to develop anti-gravity devices, which are based on electromagnetics, to kind of neutralize or change these electromagnetic fields. So Blavatsky's concepts about gravity, the non-existence of gravity. See, scientists think that the main causative formation in creation, the formation of galaxies is due to gravity, formation of a solar system due to gravity, formation of planets due to gravity, which kind of causes the mass to aggregate together. So scientists think that gravity is the main formative force in the universe, whereas Blavatsky denies that. She sees things as maintained through the ethers and through zero-point, the fact that living planets and suns and galaxies have zero-point centers by which they are rooted into the infinite. And they have these dynamic centers, and their influences permeate space, and that's what holds it all together. And when the universe collapses at the end of time, as Blavatsky says it will, it won't be due to the fact that there was enough mass in the universe to hold it together. Instead, Blavatsky says what'll ingather the universe at the end of time will be the breath of the mother, of the divine mother, will ingather the universe. He talks about the expansion and contraction of the universes as the expansion is connected to the breath of the Father, which is hot and expands. And then the mother, the different cycle, one cycle passes over to another, and the breath of the mother ingathers the universe again to her bosom. So, and her bosom is like the whole universe, the life force returning into the zero-point center. Okay, so in Blavatsky, what'll ingather the universe at the end of time is not the influence of galaxy, but it's this movement within hyperspace fields. It has to do with the electromagnetic zero-point fields that permeate the ethers that we live in. Like, we have to understand the nature of the space within which we live and move and have our being. And it's seven-dimensional. There's seven levels to it. That space and different influences permeate different levels of the ether. So, see, Blavatsky also, if you knew about Blavatsky in 1888, you would have predicted the uncertainty principle in modern physics, which says that you cannot measure a particle's exact position and momentum simultaneously. And while you would have predicted, see, in Blavatsky's view, a little particle is ultimately an expression of the infinite. It emerges out of the infinite. So whenever you try to examine the nature of a particle as though it existed just in and of itself, that's not what it is. Because that particle, if you go penetrate into its interior nature, it passes into the infinite because it's an expression of the infinite. See, it doesn't exist just as itself as a little particle. That's why if you try to measure its position more and more closely, its possible momentum and energy level becomes infinite. Or if you try to measure its energy level, then its position becomes infinitely unknown. Because when you try to examine what the particle is, it passes into the infinite. Okay, so that's what Blavatsky said. So that's the basis of what the uncertainty principle is.
Yeah.
You see, you can't, a little particle, it doesn't exist as a thing, a little thing in and of itself. That's just not what it is. You know, it's like you penetrate to the heart of anything and it passes into the infinite. That's the concept.
In Hawking's book, too, is that, you know, these are big questions, you know, which are posed by developments in physics, but he just sort of doesn't, like you said, you know, he's taught there's no discussion of non-locality and no discussion of this, the real implications of the holographic paradigm, of course, there's no relation of the fact that, you know, what mystics and esoteric teachings have described in terms of the holographic realities of things are entirely consistent with the holographic paradigm. The quote, by the way, from Hawking was, nearly everyone in the 18th and 19th centuries believed that the universe was essentially unchanging in time. One could equally well believe that it had existed forever or that it had been created in its present form a finite time ago. Now, the other thing, too, is that, I mean, in addition to Madame Blavatsky, is like within Hindu cosmology, you have the idea of an oscillating universe, like, which expands into tracks. And, I mean, this is a very well-known, you know, ancient idea, thousands and thousands and thousands of years old. So what's he talking about? You know, like, I mean, nearly everyone, I mean, he obviously doesn't know what he's talking about. Like, you know, nearly everybody in Western science might not, or Westerners might have believed that, but, I mean, that's a very common idea in Hinduism.
He doesn't have that kind of perspective, and so he kind of he steps where angels should fear to tread, kind of to go from his science to kind of philosophizing as he does. You know, it's so interesting that I think the best anecdote to the grand design at this time is my book, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. Like, it goes into all these issues that he talks about, expanding, contracting universes, vacuum genesis, singularities, higher dimensional spaces, and everything he talks about, I kind of talk about, but I give a more comprehensive treatment in my book and draw up all these enigmas. And you can kind of see how, you know, when you read this book on the secret doctrine of Blavatsky and how it relates to modern science, I mean, it's astonishing. Even into the newer ideas, more advanced than anything Hawking talks about, which is this holographic model of higher dimensional, in physics it's called anti-de Sitter space, but in Blavatsky's it would having the seven-dimensional hyperspace. Like, it's, you know, it's so funny that his books just come out, The Grand Design, and what I'm showing in my book, I'm arguing for intelligent design, but not only just arguing for it philosophically, but actually explaining Blavatsky's model of how it occurs through zero-point centers, seven-dimensional hyperspace, holes dug in space, and other such concepts. I mean, it's a remarkable, you know, what my book offers is a reinterpretation of all the kinds of facts and theories of modern science, but from a mystical perspective, saying, wow, these are like the newest ideas in science let us understand what Blavatsky was saying. So science, in a way, is validating Blavatsky's concepts.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole discussion, right? I mean, it's a,
yeah.
You know, there has to be a dialogue between these things. And
Hawking
has said, you know, I very much disapprove of mysticism, but I've never read anything in any of his writings or his interviews or anything that suggests to me that he really knows the first thing about mysticism. I don't think he does. I think he has this very kind of stereotypical understanding of it as dealing with things which are ineffable and which are based on heightened states of emotion and that don't involve any kind of intellectualization or abstraction and are non-empirical and, you know, I mean, all wrong, of course, but you know, that's what I think he thinks when he means when he talks about how he disapproves of mysticism. He says at one point, you know, if you can't do the mathematics of physics, you turn to mysticism, which is, you know,
yeah,
ludicrous. And Feynman, who he quotes, you know, says at one point, and Sagan sort of quoted, built on Feynman too, says, I find the mystical viewpoint too provincial, too you know, comfortable, too provincial. That's the word they use, is provincial.
Yeah.
Eh? And it's like, it's nothing like, it's completely not provincial. That's what so it's talking
no.
about. It's so amazing about it. It's the very antithesis of provincial. It's
yeah,
quite
exactly.
extraordinary. It's like the views that come out of modern science. It inspires you with the mystery of everything in creation, and it's like it's extremely complicated. There's nothing provincial about it whatsoever.
No.
I mean the idea that somehow there's a point source within you that if you knew yourself in this dimension that you would know the universe. How is that provincial? You know, like,
yeah.
I mean, that's you know, that's a big province. I mean, it's such an astonishingly against our normal understanding of the nature of reality. Like, it's completely
yeah.
against common sense, which is one of the things that Sagan says in his books and that Hawking says in this current book. Is like, well, science teaches us things that, you know, really violate our expectations of common sense and really, you know, can't be anticipated. Well, of course, you know, but so does mysticism. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of things that we find out about the world that refers again to the question of scale, is that within our normal common sense, these things are like, how could reality be that way? Like, it makes absolutely no sense, but you know, the evidence is there that this is the way things are. So we have to go beyond our common sense. But that's
yeah.
not, it's not only science yeah. that's revealed that. Like I say, who would think that, you know, if you could know yourself, you would know the universe and the gods?
Yeah, that would be a possibility. And that it could
yeah.
be a science to that.
Yeah,
I see we're just down to a final
yeah.
couple minutes. So I just want to end on this one quote, which I've always liked, and it's from Shirley MacLaine's book, Going Within, when she went and met Stephen
oh, yeah.
Hawking and his wife. And it's, I have this in the Heart Doctrine book. And Shirley MacLaine's writing, she says, I don't remember who made the initial foray into the discussions of truth beyond what is possible. In any event, Jane, Mrs. Hawking, said she was often frustrated with Stephen and his scientific approach to truth because she felt there was an explanation for life that lay in the lap of the gods and the heart. Okay. And then, I don't like mysticism, Stephen said via his voice box computer, but my wife and I don't always agree. He smiled at her and then at me. But I need the heart because physics isn't everything. He hesitated a moment and then said, I need heart and physics, but I believe that when I die and it will be finished. That's so ironic because in a way what I'm saying is that you can have the heart and you can have the physics, and in fact there's actually a higher dimensional physics to the human heart. And that when Stephen Hawking dies, if he wants it to be finished, he can hang out for a while and enjoy his nothingness. But there are other possibilities. yeah. in this universe of 10 to 500 possibilities. Okay, I'd like to thank BBS Radio. Thanks, Jim. It was a quite delighted discussion part of today. And
yeah, let's talk about psychological illusions in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I thought I was excited to do that. It was fun to get back to it today. And we can still be coming back to Blavatsky and the Secret Doctor material, too. I'll get that package out to you. And encourage people out there, look on Amazon.com. These three are Psychological Illusions, My God Science Book, and The Heart Doctrine are really quite profound books and worth $24.95. Okay, thank you all. Thanks, BBS Radio. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Goodbye.